Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. It's the day we talk about the management of ER-positive and triple-negative breast cancer with Dr. Sarah Tulaney from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. We have a great faculty for this series, and later on, we'll show you the results of a survey that we did of the faculty of the usual clinical practice patterns. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We put out a real quick 1-minute survey for you to take at the beginning here and also at the end. You'll get a lot more out of this meeting if you take the survey, and we'll learn a little bit more about you as well. We do webinars all the time. Tomorrow we got a really interesting one. We're going to try something we've never tried before. It's a follow-up to the GI ASCO meetings on upper GI cancer and hepatobiliary cancers. I'll just say, check it out. It's going to be very different. No slides. We're just talking tomorrow night. Anyhow, we're going to continue our colorectal series on March the 22nd with Dr. Strickler. Then we're heading over to the SGO meeting, Society of Gynecologic Oncology. We'll be doing two satellites there that also will be broadcast simultaneously. The first on Sunday morning, March the 26th, on ovarian cancer. And then a really interesting one on the 27th on endometrial cancer. Two big phase 3 studies going to be presented, chemo plus IO. They're both positive. We'll see what it means in terms of practice. We'll also be doing continuing our year in review series looking at AML and MDS on April the 4th. We have a great faculty, Dr. Barat and Dr. Arwai from Australia. And then we'll finish out this series, ER-positive or triple-negative disease, probably talk about all the controversies that come up tonight with Dr. Hurwitz and on April the 12th. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars, so if you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Tulaney's colleague, Dr. Mayer, on ER-positive breast cancer. But Sarah, today we're here to talk about ER-positive triple-negative breast cancer, as always. We're going to try to present 8 cases to you from a community-based docs. Most of these are general medical oncologists. So they're going to present cases. We're going to present at SGO that we just presented at the GU meeting. Really amazing to be a general medical oncologist nowadays, trying to keep up with all the stuff that's going on. But we're going to make rounds with Dr. Tulaney. We're going to start out with a couple of papers that she did that really doesn't tie into any of the cases, but I thought was really interesting, including some work on male breast cancer, and then we'll go through a bunch of cases of ER-positive and then triple-negative disease. We put in a big appendix there for you, a bunch of other papers and data you might want to check out. But Sarah, I've always been kind of confused about male breast cancer. I saw several publications that you were involved with, survival in male breast cancer, also response to neoadjuvant chemo. Can you talk a little bit about, I don't know, maybe some common myths or misperception, and in particular, how you think through hormonal therapy of a man?
Yeah, no, good question. These papers were done by my colleague, Dr. Pablo Leon, who actually oversees our male breast cancer program at Dana-Farber. And so it is definitely a huge area of interest for us. You know, one thing that's important to realize is that the distribution of breast cancer is different in males compared to females. So almost 90% of cases are going to be hormone receptor positive. And so again, important to remember that it's unusual to see other subtypes outside of hormone receptor positive disease. I think the other thing to realize in some of the work done by Pablo shown here was that males tend to unfortunately not do quite as well as women. When you compare them, matching males to females and look at outcomes, you can see that the outcomes are not quite as good as females. This particular paper you're showing here, looking at neoadjuvant chemotherapy, you can see much lower PCR rates for males when matched to females by subtype. Obviously, numbers of subtypes are lower in the HER2 positive and triple negative subgroups since they're much more rare, but still you see PCR is lower. So, you know, I think it's a challenge because numbers of patients are low. And so we do have a lot of unknown questions. So your question about optimal endocrine therapy is a very good one. I think traditionally we've thought of treating males with tamoxifen, but I think our question still lies is, is there a benefit to using GnRH agonists? And is use of an aromatase inhibitor, do you need to use a GnRH agonist? And would it be better to use that in a male compared to a female? And so Pablo actually has our very first male breast cancer trial that is going to be opening hopefully in the next month that is going to try to address this endocrine question, where he's going to randomize males in the preoperative setting to these different endocrine interventions to try to address this very question and looking at biological changes in the tumor based on the type of endocrine therapy they receive preoperatively. So I think a very important question that does need to be addressed that we don't have a good answer to, but certainly that's what the goal of this trial will be.
Yeah, I don't know whether to consider a man with breast cancer more like a postmenopausal patient or a premenopausal patient, where you have the testes as an indirect source of the androgens. Before I ask you about the next paper, a quick question from the chat room. Dr. Rudolph wants to know how you follow men with breast cancer. Do you do mammograms, yearly mammograms on them?
So most of our male patients have had mastectomy. And so for most of these patients, we are following them with physical examination, very similar to how we would a woman.
Okay, so we cannot get through any conference nowadays without talking about circulating DNA and MRD. Every part, particularly solid, not only solid tumors, incidentally. So anyhow, here's a paper you had looking at this. Makes a lot of sense. We see delayed recurrence. The whole idea, maybe we could try to pick out the women that need longer therapy, longer hormonal therapy, because they have positive MRDs at the end of 5 years. And this is a paper you did looking at that exactly. Can you? And this is the editorial that went with it. Very excited about the work that you all did. Can you summarize what you saw there and where you think this is heading?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. Trying to use ctDNA to figure out which patients are at high risk of recurrence is, you know, a huge area of research. So Heather Parsons, who runs our ctDNA program at the Farber, worked with Marla Lipsick-Sharp here to try to address this question in the patients who have hormone receptor positive early stage disease, but are at that 4 to 5 year timeframe, really trying to address the question, what is the prevalence of detecting ctDNA at that time point? And what happens to a patient who has detectable ctDNA? Will they recur, and at what time frame? And in essence, what we found was that about 10% of patients at this time point will have detectable ctDNA. And unfortunately, it does indicate that they will recur, because all of these patients ended up having a recurrence of their breast cancer. The median time from time of detection to time of recurrence was about 12 months, but that does have quite a range to it. And so I do think this test, you know, in this particular assay, used the RaDaR assay by Inivata, which is a pretty sensitive assay. So it does seem like it is very specific for recurrence. I think the problem right now is still sensitivity, meaning what percent of patients look like they have a negative assay, but truly are positive. And I think that's where we're still not perfect with these tests yet. And so I think they're not ready for prime time, in a sense that I don't know what to do with the information. I know it means that the patient has a high risk of recurrence if they're detectable, but we don't have data to know how can we intervene and prevent that recurrence. And so I think it's hard to recommend getting an assay when you don't know what to do with the information. And so we're not routinely recommending checking for MRD at this point in time.
So I was mentioning, we have a webinar coming up looking at colorectal cancer. And one of the things we're going to talk about is, and somebody in the chat room, Michelle, wants to know what the MRD assay actually is. But of course, in colon cancer, they have the Signatera assay, and they're using it in the adjuvant setting, not as what you described. But these are like tumor. Can you explain like how the assay is done? Because it's tumor informed. So it's related specifically to that patient's tumor. And that's why they come up with the idea that maybe we're really looking at a minimal residual disease, MRD. Can you talk about how they do the assay?
So you're right. This particular assay that had been done in this study was that Inivata RaDaR assay, where it is a tumor-informed assay. So in essence, they sequence the tumor and of that individual patient, and then they track, you know, in this case, patients had serial blood drawn, plasma drawn, and then they look for the mutations that were seen in the baseline tumor in the blood. So can they detect in the ctDNA those particular tumors, mutations, to know that, again, it is that breast cancer that is present. It's a good way to you know, increase your sensitivity of detection by using a tumor-informed assay in this case. So, you know, it is, again, these assays are very good because you can see that if you find it, it really does mean that this patient, unfortunately, is likely to recur.
Yeah, and colon, they're using it stage 4 NED also. You know, you take out a met or you take out a liver met, you know, if they have liver-confined disease. So really interesting to see whether breast cancer is going to follow along that way. Okay, let's make some rounds here. We've got some cases. We're going to start out with a patient of Dr. Astral, young woman, 32 years old, premenopausal. Here's the case and here's his question.
She would very much like to stop her hormonal therapy and attempt pregnancy. What would you advise the woman?
What's her current status?
I told the patient that I've heard that there's going to be a big presentation about the safety of becoming pregnant after a breast cancer diagnosis. So I asked her to wait until San Antonio, and she said fine to that. So right now, she's continuing this therapy, and she's anxiously awaiting Dr. Partridge's presentation.
What about olaparib for her?
Would any members of the panel stretch the indications and consider for a patient such as this? And what do we know about toxicity of olaparib long term? You know, this is a young woman.
So I should have mentioned that she did have a BRCA2 germline mutation as well, K67, 40%. And she was treated with ovarian suppression and an AI and has been on it for 3 years. And at that point, brought up the issue of whether or not maybe she could attempt pregnancy. And, of course, we actually did a webinar, I'm going to talk about it later, too, with your colleague, Dr. Partridge, who did the positive trial presentation. We've shown these slides before. You've been talking about it a lot since San Antonio, because everybody was asking about it. But without showing these slides, can you just kind of talk about your sort of version of what was done there? I don't know if you actually, I imagine you might have had some patients actually on the study. Really amazing thing. They had 500 patients internationally. Kind of what's your summary of the study and what do you think it means?
I know, I agree. I think the positive trial is a very important trial, and what an incredible effort to do this study and to answer a question we've all had in our heads, which is that if you have a young woman sitting before you who desires pregnancy, is it safe to interrupt that endocrine therapy and then restart it after, you know, childbirth to, you know, would that change her risk of recurrence? And so in the positive study, patients were allowed to take endocrine therapy for 18 to 24 months. And after that time period, they could then interrupt their endocrine therapy, go on to try to conceive. And then after delivering, could resume their endocrine treatment. They followed those patients, in essence, in a single arm fashion to look at event rate. And then they compared the event rate to patients from the soft text analysis in a matched manner to look at how patients would have done with people who got optimal endocrine therapy without an interruption to see if their rate of recurrence was any different. I think one thing to keep in mind with the positive data is that it was predominantly lower risk patients. So about 50% of people were stage one and 50% of patients were stage two. I think the other thing to keep in mind is duration of follow-up is fairly short in an ER positive population where we know events can happen late. In this case, the follow-up time was about, median follow-up was about 41 months. And so I think the data suggested that it's safe to interrupt in lower risk patients with this sort of follow-up time frame, because what they saw was there did not seem to be an increased rate of recurrence when compared to people in the soft text analysis. And so it seemed like that interruption was not increasing rate of recurrence. You have to remember, though, there were still patients who did recur. So about 8% of patients actually recurred while they were off their endocrine treatment. And so it's not saying that, you know, there's no risk of recurrence from interruption. We know that these patients do have risk, but it didn't seem to be any different, at least at this time point. But we don't know, again, with longer follow-up, will that hold up? And what does that mean to a higher stage patient? And so if we circle back to this particular patient, it's a stage one patient, but did have a high genomic risk score, and does have a BRCA mutation. And so, you know, I think obviously this is a discussion and you have to weigh risk benefit. In this case, the patient is pretty young. So one could have a conversation with her. Does she want to wait another year or two? You know, it's probably okay for her to wait and think about conceiving when, again, at least she's gotten through maybe the 5 years of therapy. However, if someone really wants to go on to conceive, you could say, well, you know, you fit into the data that we have from positive. Again, you did have a stage one cancer. It's probably okay to do. But again, we don't have long-term follow-up data from this. And so I think it is a conversation with the patient.
Hey, maybe someday she'll be getting a circulating DNA.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So the other question he brought up, as you mentioned, is a T1C node negative patient. This patient does have a BRCA germline mutation. Is the issue of adjuvant PARP inhibitor, specifically olaparib, which she technically would not fit into in terms of the indication. But let me ask you a question, whether or not you think is advisable based on risk or benefit, do you think her risk of recurrence would be lowered by giving olaparib adjuvantly?
That's a good question. You know, we know in the Olympia study, the people with ER positive disease had to have 4 positive nodes or had to have residual disease after preoperative therapy and have a CPS CG score greater than or equal to 3. So they were particularly high risk ER positive patients. So actually our group did an analysis where we looked at what percent of patients in our, you know, database at Dana-Farber had BRCA mutations, and of them, how many would have been eligible for Olympia? And then we looked at outcomes for those patients who didn't meet eligibility compared to those who did. And it looks like you have that. And so in that particular analysis, it did seem like the people who met eligibility had a, you know, higher risk of having a recurrence, by not by much though. And so it did make us wonder, are we missing people who have similar risk of recurrence to the Olympia population, but weren't included? Because now we have, you know, genomic risk scores that help us understand risk outside of just anatomic risk. And so I do wonder if there are patients who would benefit from use of olaparib, but obviously you have to weigh risk benefit. And certainly this is a year of a PARP inhibitor, which is associated with toxicity, including, you know, cytopenias, nausea, et cetera. And so, you know, in this particular patient, she had a stage one cancer, even though she had a high genomic risk score. It's not someone I would offer olaparib to, simply because her risk of recurrence overall, having a stage one tumor, isn't sort of high enough to meet the threshold, at least at this point, to warrant giving olaparib.
So, and here's the ASCO guideline and, you know, some of the specifics that you just talked about. But if this same woman had one positive node, she still would not be, over the bar. If you could, would you offer olaparib with one positive node?
This is where it gets tricky, right? Because while she's not anatomically high risk, that genomic assay makes you think her risk isn't sort of the average one positive node patient. And so, you know, I don't think it's crazy, but I would say we just don't have data to do it. And, you know, I would have a discussion with the patient who had a high genomic risk score and had nodal involvement.
So just so as long as we're talking about Olympia, I want to put in this from the survey we did. This is actually a triple negative patient with a BRCA germline. So now you also have the issue of PARP inhibitor, of IO as well. And we say that the CPS is positive. Most people would still just go with olaparib, although a couple people would like to do both olaparib and pembro. Any thoughts about this scenario and how, and particularly with triple negative where you've got PD-1 to consider, how you think this one through?
Yeah, so good question. So in someone who received neoadjuvant pembrolizumab and chemotherapy, like a KEYNOTE-522 patient, and if they had residual disease, then I would give them both pembro and olaparib in the adjuvant setting. You know, I think we don't have data for doing this, but knowing that olaparib has both disease-free survival and overall survival benefit in a triple-negative patient with residual disease, I do think we should recommend it. Obviously, Olympia was done at a time when patients had not received prior immunotherapy, But I do think, again, the benefit is so high that it's important to offer it. The question about continuing Pembro in this case, if they had gotten it preoperatively, you know, we don't know the benefit of doing that, but because it was standardly offered in 522, and that's what the EFS data is based off of, I do usually continue the Pembro and give it concurrently with the olaparib in a residual disease patient. We do have some safety data for giving olaparib and checkpoint, and so I felt comfortable doing that. This particular case, the patient hadn't received, at least my understanding was they had not gotten preoperative checkpoint and they just got pre-op chemo. And so that's why I did not offer the checkpoint inhibitor, because again, we don't have any data to know what the benefit of checkpoint in the adjuvant setting is for someone who didn't get it pre-op.
We got to go back and ask that question again with neoadjuvant. So another question related to Olympia is, you know, putting aside access and approval, what kind of genomic profile would have you want to use a PARP inhibitor? We asked here about PALB2, which we jokingly call BRCA3, and everybody says they would do it. You're the only one who actually has done it. But in general, how far will you go? People ask about ATM, somatic versus germline. Again, putting aside the indication, how wide would you cast the net in this adjuvant situation?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know that we'll ever really have data given how rare some of these mutations are. But because we have data in the metastatic setting where we've looked at benefits of PARP inhibition in germline PALB2, where the response rates look on par, if not higher numerically than what we've seen with BRCA mutant patients. This was also true with somatic BRCA mutant tumors in the metastatic setting. I'm extrapolating that data from the metastatic setting where I would feel comfortable using a PARP in a germline PALB2 or somatic BRCA to the adjuvant setting. Truthfully, I don't usually get genomic sequencing off of a patient in the adjuvant setting, so I don't usually know somatic mutational status. But because we do get germline testing, we will find sometimes these germline PALB2s. And again, given the benefit seen in the metastatic setting, I'm willing to do that. We've not seen benefit with ATM, for example, with PARP alone. And so I have not extrapolated it to other mutations. I've been pretty restrictive to what we've seen for metastatic data with, again, germline PALB2, somatic BRCA, and germline BRCA.
We're getting some wild cases in the chat room, but let me stick with the videos for the time being and get into our next. Now that we're warmed up, we'll get into the part that I don't understand. I've really been interesting. 2023 in breast cancer has been very interesting for me because I'm learning a lot about premenopausal breast cancer. So let's start with this case and then we'll get into the question that I have. So 38-year-old woman, T2N0, ER positive, HER2 negative, recurrent score 35. And she gets adjuvant TC. She chooses to have TAH in her ovaries taken out and is put on letrozole and has very severe symptoms and is then switched to tamoxifen. Here's the case.
I just had a visit with her in the last 2 or 3 weeks. She said, you know, Dr. Gupta, I stopped it because I just could not take the hot flashes. She works in the hospital as an MA. So when she starts having hot flashes and the aches and pains, she becomes nauseous. And that is very disruptive to her. So I restarted the tamoxifen. I find that it is very, very difficult to give AIs in a premenopausal woman. And a lot of times I put them back on tamoxifen. So how do the investigators kind of work in this situation? Do you still push for an aromatase inhibitor and then we keep on adding more treatments for the supportive care? Or are they comfortable switching back to tamoxifen? Vaginal dryness is another very significant toxicity. And these are very young patients. Is this affecting their married life? You know, sexual dysfunction is something that we don't talk about, but is in the front and center of these patients' life. I always struggle about using low-dose vaginal estrogen creams for the vaginal dryness. What are the other things that they use in their clinic to kind of take care of these?
So one thing just to remind you, she had a surgical BSO, so she wasn't an LHR agonist. So one thing I want to ask you before we get into her questions about side effects is if you have a patient on ovarian suppression and an AI and they're having intolerable issues, do you go to tamoxifen alone or do you keep the ovarian suppression going and add in tamoxifen?
Usually I do a stepwise approach. So if they're on ovarian suppression AI, and they're miserable, then I go to ovarian suppression tamoxifen, because I'm not sure what's driving, you know, a lot of the symptoms. Is it the ovarian suppression? Is it the AI? Is it both? So I usually go and try the tamoxifen and keep the ovarian suppression on board, since we know, again, there is benefit from the ovarian suppression component. But then again, if that's really too much and they can't handle that and they're still quite miserable, then I drop the ovarian suppression and leave them on tamoxifen.
Any clinical pearls maybe that you share with your fellows about management of these symptoms, particularly vaginal dryness? You know, everybody has the concerns about using anything with estrogen in there. How do you approach it?
Usually our recommendation is, I think as oncologists, we need to be a little bit better about talking about vaginal health. And so upfront, we do need to tell patients that when we use medications like aromatase inhibitors and GnRH agonists, that we need to be offering vaginal moisturizers routinely to patients, that they need to be using these 3 to 5 times a week. Things that are, you know, over-the-counter vaginal moisturizers work very well. They have no hormones in them. And it's important to maintain your vaginal health. However, for some patients, this is still not enough. And so even moisturization and lubrication isn't enough. And in that case, then the question does come up, you know, is it safe to use any estrogenic-based vaginal therapies? There is some data here, and most of the data does seem to suggest that sort of the very lowest dose of estrogen suppositories, like Avagifem, is something that we often will use in patients when they've really failed, you know, non-hormonal therapies. Again, you know, the data seems to be reasonable at a very low dose. And so that's what I've done. I tend not to use any estrogenic based creams because that's where the systemic absorption is higher. And so we do stick with the low dose suppositories. But, you know, again, I do try to avoid that. And I do really try to stick with the non-hormonal based treatment and try to do that upfront.
So here's my question. What's the algorithm for determining whether or not right up front you're going to recommend tamoxifen alone without ovarian suppression? And so I want to run by you, and there was two papers from Soft and Text, as you know, just got published in the JCO with an interesting editorial by one of the people who participated in a webinar we did a few weeks ago, Kathy Miller. So here's kind of what I'm seeing in the literature. I'm not sure if I'm seeing it correctly. You tell me. So first of all, when you look at these three potential endocrine interventions in premenopausal women, do you think that ovarian AI is better than ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen, and they're both better than tamoxifen?
Yeah, I think the data from Soft and Text do tell us that ovarian suppression aromatase inhibition is superior to ovarian suppression and tamoxifen. And we know from Soft that that's better than tamoxifen. But these benefits really seem to be the most significant in patients who are very young, so patients under the age of 35, or patients who have high risk. So patients, for example, had received chemotherapy or had tumors over 2 centimeters or had high-grade tumors. Those are the patients where we've seen these benefits be significant and largest. And so, you know, when we think of offering ovarian suppression, we are keeping that in the back of our minds. We're trying to understand age and risk. And so, you know, I think we are usually offering ovarian suppression and AI to the patients at high risk. So patients who've gotten chemotherapy or who have, for example, high recurrence scores, larger tumors, higher grade cancers, that's where we tend to start at the top of this particular algorithm.
So it's the granularity of this algorithm that I'm kind of noting to be very interesting and different than what I see in the literature. Here are the two papers that just got published in the JCO. Great. We're seeing 12-year follow-up. Looks like the benefits that you just described are continuing long-term. Here's the editorial. And I just want to bring up a few comments right from the editorial. So first of all, they say just what you said. So age less than 35, T2, grade 3. They don't talk about node positive, but I assume node positive. So you already mentioned that. They talked about using a stepwise approach where you do the ovarian suppression first and then add in the AI. And then the question is, is it, what about going with tamoxifen alone? And they say this may be a consideration in patients who have, quote, lower risk disease. So we have a very simple way of trying to figure out what the algorithms are for real, which is we just ask investigators what they do. And incidentally, this is a paper, this is a abstract poster we did at San Antonio looking at the issues, the numeric issues in HER2-positive disease, which I'm going to bring that discussion into ER-positive disease. And here's what I don't see in the editorial. I don't see it in the guidelines, but this is a reality, which is it looks like recurrence score is a pretty important factor in deciding whether you use tamoxifen alone. So we present a young patient, 30 years old. Incidentally, that's less than the bar in the editorial. And you can see that tamoxifen is a common choice if the recurrence score is low, like you were saying. It almost seems like if they give chemo, which is determined in node-negative patients to a great extent by recurrence score, they're going to go with more, you know, intensified hormonal therapy. You go up in size, 1.5 centimeter node-negative, 2. Now you're starting to see a little more on the left side with the low recurrence score, 2.5 centimeters. And you say 2.5 centimeter woman with node negative tumor, she has a low recurrence score, you're going to offer her tamoxifen, which is fine. I mean, you know, maybe you're, but my question is, if that woman said to you, if I do ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen, will my recurrence rate be any lower? I understand it may not be worth it, but how much would it be? Would it be 2% lower, 5% lower? So, I mean, you probably have patients who are medical oncologists who can understand all this. How would you answer them?
So I think, you know, in retrospect, I might change my answer here on this one just because she's 30 in particular. But I will say that, you know, I do think there is additional benefit as, again, the tumor size gets larger. And here, again, now we're over 2 centimeters. And so while her recurrence score is low and her absolute risk of recurrence, you know, is not large, it's still larger than the 1 centimeter tumor that we just presented before. And here's where we're trying to weigh risk benefit, right? And so I think you are at a point where you are going to get, you know, probably a few percent benefit from the ovarian suppression in this case, probably 2-3% absolute benefit. And so I do think it's worth a discussion, even in the recurrent score 8 patient, because again, that absolute benefit probably is now a couple percent, 2-3%. And so we have to have a conversation with her about the toxicities and if she's willing to give it a try. And so I would have a discussion, you know, in this particular patient. But I think it comes back to your point of who gets TAM alone and where do we cross that threshold to giving ovarian suppression. And I think, again, it has to do with risk. And so it's really trying to understand where that risk threshold changes.
And you have the RSClin, which is really a great tool to come up with some numbers to begin to talk about. And I think you can probably pull it out of there if you're, you know, looking for it. But, you know, the issue, you know, for breast cancer is the one that really, I think, really established the territory of patient involvement in difficult decisions in the adjuvant setting. So I guess I would think that maybe patients at least deserve some numbers. That's what I'd like to find out. What numbers are you giving to these people? Certainly, if there's one positive node, that looks like a consensus to me. So positive node, we're really talking about node negative. Also, the issue, we talked about this a lot in the seminar we did before, of fertility preservation, and looks like most people will do that, particularly in younger patients. But also to give LHRH during chemotherapy, not only for fertility preservation, but for ovarian function, to, you know, prevent premature menopause, if that's what you want to do. Any thoughts about the use of LHRH agonists during chemotherapy in breast cancer to improve fertility and ovarian function, Sarah?
I mean, I think it is really important because we do have very clear data that it does help preserve ovarian function and can help women who desire having future children. And so, you know, it is something to offer, you know, and as you point out, this is more of a discussion with their younger women who do desire having children in the future. And so I am offering it. It's safe. There's no increased risk of recurrence. In fact, there may be some benefit from giving it concurrently. And so, again, I do offer it.
So let's go through a few cases that really have very specific issues. This is a patient of Dr. Zanetta Lamar, a 53-year-old woman who presents with two breast cancer, bilateral breast cancer, because of insurance problem. The patient wasn't able to get to surgery right away, so She had a recurrence score done on both of these tumors. Here's the case.
This is a 53-year-old postmenopausal woman who was found to have bilateral breast cancer. We had some insurance-related delays getting her to surgery, and I ultimately performed an Oncotype on the biopsy specimen instead of the surgical specimen. On the left side, the Oncotype recurrence score was low. However, on the right side, the Oncotype recurrence score was 30. When I went back and I looked at the size of the biopsy specimen on the right side, it was 4 millimeters. Here's my question for the investigators. In this patient, she actually only has 4 millimeters of disease. Typically, we would not have sent the Oncotype if the disease were not 5 millimeters or more. However, now I'm stuck with this high recurrence score. After a discussion of pros and cons, the patient opted not to have chemotherapy, but I am curious what you would do in this scenario.
Any thoughts?
It's an interesting case because it's true. I don't order a recurrence score on someone with a very tiny tumor because the absolute benefit of chemotherapy in that patient, even with the high recurrence score, is going to just be too low to make it worth it. In this particular case, I probably would have given, if again, you're waiting and you're delayed to surgery, and let's say you're trying to give them something while you're waiting to get to the OR, if it was going to be a few months for some reason, then I might give an AI in the preoperative setting and see what's found at the time of surgery. Because the problem in this scenario is you didn't know nodal status and you didn't know tumor size. And so I would want that information from the time of surgery to make the determination about if I would want to give chemotherapy or not. If the tumor ended up being larger or having nodal involvement, then I could always give the adjuvant chemotherapy at that point in time. But I could use that AI in the interim while we were waiting on the surgery.
Any comment about this editorial you and your group did in the JCO, really verbalizing a question I've been hearing everybody ask ever since, you know, we got into the issue of our responder and then the adjuvant Abema study, which of course we just saw a change in the FDA approval. But everybody was saying, well, we're supposed to count nodes, but we're not counting nodes because we do the sentinel node if it's positive. We don't do an axillary dissection. You get into that dilemma here. Any comments about your conclusion? It sounds like you're still in favor of not doing axillary dissections.
Yeah, that's right. I think very much to your point. When you look at the data for picking, you know, people who need abemaciclib, if you're 1 to 3 nodes and you don't meet the tumor size or grade, you're wondering, well, what if I did the dissection and they had 4 more positive nodes and they'd be eligible for abema? And with our responder, once people have 4 or more nodes, we don't use recurrence score at this point in time. We just give chemotherapy because we don't have any data to know that we can omit chemo. And so this question does come up is if you don't know the number of nodes, have you made the right decision? And, you know, I think this was something we did discuss in the article that from a local regional standpoint, you're not gaining any additional benefit by doing that dissection. In fact, you're putting that risk at putting that patient at risk for lymphedema. And so, you know, usually what we've used is the information that we have from the time of surgery. And then, you know, I think sometimes we also factor in what's the probability that there would be additional nodal involvement, knowing the number of nodes that were ascertained from the time of surgery compared to the number that were positive. And if the probability is quite high that there are additional nodes involved, usually we do take that into consideration when making that medical decision about systemic therapy.
So let's move on now, talk a little bit about metastatic disease. And Dr. Lorber has, again, a premenopausal patient, 42 years old. Interestingly, she actually got treated by prior to coming to Dr. Lorber a couple years previously for a stage 2B ER positive HER2 low tumor. She got adjuvant tamoxifen, thinking back to our conversation before. So it makes me wonder how much adjuvant tamoxifen is going on in these patients. In any event, presented with widespread metastatic disease, Dr. Lorber, She gets put on ovarian suppression, letrozole, and palbo. Here are his questions.
I started the patient on letrozole, ovarian suppression, abemaciclib, and then she also underwent radiation to the painful lytic lesions in her right femur and her lumbar spine. And she required a right total hip replacement after being assessed by orthopedics. Roughly a month after starting therapy with me, I had to hold her abemaciclib because of diarrhea that was really impairing her day-to-day activity, and then switched her to palbociclib, which thus far she's tolerated. So in this type of patient, is there a best strategy in choosing amongst the three inhibitors in the metastatic setting? And then given she has a BRCA2 mutation and also has a HER2 1+ expression, what would be the ideal next therapy at progression after CDK4/6 inhibitor and AI?
Do you have any questions about management of HER2 low disease?
Does distinguishing 1+ or 2+ have any influence on how soon you may introduce trastuzumab duratuxin?
Any questions on screening for ILD with T-DXd?
Yeah, I've been approaching it mainly with checking at every visit just a symptomatic change in terms of dyspnea, cough, and then looking at their O2 sats. I have not been doing any kind of dedicated imaging beyond what they would get normally for monitoring their cancer, but I'm not sure if that's the optimal approach.
So it's like rounds. It's surprising how many questions you can get in 30 seconds here, but let me just sort of summarize them. So first, the debate about choice of CDK in the first line setting, the ribo survival data and how that's affected you, pre versus postmenopausal. Why don't we start with that and then we'll get into post CDK.
We'll start with an easy question. So I think
right. We'll start with the easy one first, right?
Right. Obviously this is highly controversial because we have these three CDK4/6 inhibitors, palbociclib, ribociclib, abemaciclib. Which one do you choose? The current dilemma is that we've seen survival benefit technically only statistically significant in the first line setting with ribociclib to date. The data with palbociclib from Paloma-2 did not reach statistical significance. The data with Monarch 3, the interim analysis had a pretty large trend to OS, about over a 10-month delta. And we will see final OS data this year from Monarch 3. And my guess is it likely will hit statistical significance given the very large difference that was seen in survival. But technically, we don't have that information right now. And so right now, I can only say the survival benefit is seen with ribociclib. And so that is what most of us are using when we're starting off with endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 at this time. We also, in this particular patient, she's premenopausal. There's phase 3 data in the premenopausal population for MONALEESA 7 with ribo, also with OS benefits. So I think very reasonable to think about. I don't think it's wrong, though, to use a different CDK. Again, I do think the Abema OS data is likely to pan out to be positive and statistically so.
So let's get into the post-CDK space, and then we'll take a look at a few papers and some of the questions we asked the faculty to address that. He brings up the issue of T-DXd and HER2 low. Before we get into secondary hormonal therapy, what about his question about 1+ versus 2+? I know it's sort of supposed to be a continuum, but are you more likely to use it in a 2+ patient, or really you just look at HER2 low as one entity?
So when they actually looked at this data in DESTINY-Breast04 and they compared efficacy data between the 1+ and 2+ patients, it was really identical. So objective response rate was the same and progression-free survival was the same for 1+ versus 2+. So it does not influence me in any way, if they're 1+ or 2+. I think of my decision to use T-DXd the same way.
So speaking of easy questions, what about screening for ILD? You'd be surprised what we hear from the GI people and the lung people and now the GYN people. But in any event, you guys have started out with it first. So everybody asks symptoms, et cetera. But what about imaging? Obviously, chest imaging in patients who are maybe not otherwise going to have imaging. We just ask people what they do. And I've been surprised how many investigators are saying they try to get imaging as much as they can, like maybe every couple months for a long time. Is that the way you approach it?
Yeah, and I think the problem here is we don't have great data. So what we do know is that the DESTINY trials all did repeat staging scans with a high-res CT every 6 weeks to evaluate patients, you know, for efficacy of the drug, but also it got them that chest imaging every 6 weeks. And so the question is it better to do it every 6 weeks compared to what we would usually do in other patients? 9-12 weeks is pretty, you know, routine. Are you maybe going to pick up lower grade ILD if you do it more often? And so, you know, we don't really have these data. No one's compared doing chest CTs every 6 versus 12 weeks to know that you're going to have less likelihood of having high grade ILD by doing it this way. But that being said, I have typically been getting scans every 6 to 9 weeks in all my patients getting TDXT because I do worry that I don't want to miss, you know, ILD developing. I want to catch it early. One, because I can intervene early. But also we know you have to discontinue TDXT for someone with grade 2 or higher ILD. And so, you know, we really like to avoid that given how efficacious this drug is. But we need more information here. We need to understand if there's a better way to monitor. Would PFTs have a role here? Could it help us understand a drop in DLCO maybe? Would that help us? We don't know the answer to that question. So I do exactly what was mentioned. I do tell the patients, tell me right away if you have any shortness of breath, cough, you know, respiratory symptoms. And I do image every 6 to 9 weeks.
So let's talk about second line hormonal therapy, because it seems like that's in the process of changing, hopefully maybe going to be a little bit more efficacious. Before we get to that, I want to ask you about this paper you did on alpelisib, because I think it maybe is going to relate to some of these new agents in terms of toxicity issues. Of course, that's been a big issue with alpelisib. What did you look at in this paper? What did you see in terms of alpelisib issues? What's your own experience with it? You know, we hear a lot of, you know, kind of negative stories from the community. I kind of wonder whether or not maybe they don't have as much experience, but yet there's a lot of breast cancer in the community. So I don't really know. You tell me what's the truth.
Yeah, you know, I will say that I think our data was pretty in line with what's been the experience with alpelisib on clinical trials that, you know, unfortunately the drug is associated with hyperglycemia and rash, which are typically reasons that end up taking patients off drug. This was actually done in collaborations with our endocrinologist group, who we've been working quite closely with to more tightly manage the hyperglycemia with alpelisib. And so, you know, it is a challenge for patients in the real world. And so, you know, patients who get alpelisib, we do try to give prophylactic antihistamines to help prevent the rash. Now we actually have some data for even using prophylactic metformin, starting it a week prior to initiating the alpelisib, which has been actually quite helpful. So if you have a patient particularly who may have a higher BMI or sort of a borderline hemoglobin A1C, I do think it's important to get them started on the metformin to make this more tolerable.
So I want to ask your thoughts. You don't see too many phase 3 trials of new endocrine treatments in breast cancer, but we saw this San Antonio, capivasertib, or like a lot of people like to call it CAPI, phase 3 trial. Can you talk about what this agent is? And I wanted to show your data on alpelisib because I also want to contrast what your take is right now on tolerability with this agent, but also, of course, efficacy. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so this was a really important study that took patients who had progressed on prior aromatase inhibition, who got randomized to get fulvestrant with or without capivasertib, with the capivasertib being an oral AKT inhibitor. So it's really inhibiting that pathway. So people who have AKT, PI3K, you know, P10 alterations, we thought this would be particularly efficacious for. This trial was, however, done in all comers. So they looked at efficacy both in the overall population and then in those patients who had a pathway alteration, again, specifically PI3K, AKT, or P10. And what they found was that there was benefit in the overall population as well as within the pathway altered group. The pathway altered group did have a larger benefit in terms of you know, improvement in terms of progression-free survival relative to the unaltered group. I think there's a little data that we still want to see, though, from this trial, which is that there were about 16% of patients in the capivasertib arm who had unknown alterations. And so it's important for us to know what those alterations are to really understand the benefit in the unaltered population. Because right now, while it seems that there is a benefit, it's not as robust as the altered group. And we really need to clean up the data to know all the mutations in the unaltered population. So again, I'd like to see a little more information, which hopefully they is supposed to come from ctDNA data from this trial that we don't have yet, but clearly large benefit, particularly in the biomarker driven population.
What about tolerability? So not only the data, but I think you've used this agent a few times, your own personal experience. And I mean, in my dim mind, it looks like it's somewhere similar to, in terms of alpelisib, at least in the pathway. So I don't know if the tolerability issues are similar or not. What are they? It looks like diarrhea is the main problem. Is that right?
That is exactly right. So diarrhea is the most common toxicity. You still do see some hyperglycemia and rash, but it's important to realize that in this trial, they allowed people to have a hemoglobin A1C up to 8.5. That's very different than in SOLAR-1, where you could only have a hemoglobin A1C of 6.5. So this took a much broader population and still had a lower rate of hyperglycemia. So to me, that's pretty important because, it does suggest that the hyperglycemia is going to be a lot less than what we see with alpelisib. And the rash does seem to be less. But, there's still are those side effects. They're just less prevalent. And again, they do have the GI side effect with the diarrhea. So I think much easier than alpelisib, but still with toxicity.
So of course, now we have SERDs. We have oral agents, I guess similar mechanistically to fulvestrant, but it looks like they're more effective. Now we have one approved. These are some slides that Dr. Javari showed in our first conference in this series. But I just wanted to get your general take on how these agents work, what your take is right now on their efficacy and tolerability, particularly compared to fulvestrant.
So we've seen, now we actually have an FDA-approved SERD, which is pretty exciting with the recent approval of elacestrant. The approval, though, was restricted to patients who have metastatic hormone receptor positive disease that have progressed on prior endocrine treatment and have an ESR1 mutation. And so I think, overall what we're seeing is that the benefits seem to be mostly in the ESR1 mutant population. And as monotherapy, that benefit is pretty modest when compared to fulvestrant, for example. We saw in EMERALD, that in the ESR1 mutant population, you see a little less than a 2-month delta between the two arms. So again, a modest benefit. In terms of toxicity, clearly one advantage is these are oral medications, which is nicer than having to get an intramuscular shot of fulvestrant. It does have some GI toxicity, though, so it does carry with it a risk of nausea. The other thing that I think important to realize that, we're not so used to monitoring, but it does have some risk of hyperlipidemia, which is not uncommon compared to AIs, for example, but you do have to monitor lipids in this patient population as well. But low rates of discontinuation, and so overall pretty well tolerated.
So this is another oral SERD, right? Yeah, anything you want to say about camizestrant? That we saw some data at San Antonio on that. And also we had a whole bunch of trials going on right now, new SERDs in development, being looked at in localized disease. Any comments on CAMI and some of these new trial strategies?
Yeah, it's nice to see there's so many new agents coming down the pipe. So the camizestrant study had looked at CAMI compared to fulvestrant and had suggested that there was benefit favoring camizestrant there, particularly in the ESR1 mutant population where the benefit was larger. One thing to keep in mind with CAMI in terms of unique toxicity is it does cause something we call photopsia, which is a visual change. And so, that is different than the other oral SERDs. Overall, it's thought not to really impact patients' daily lives. That trial, while positive, likely won't lead to any regulatory approval because it was a randomized phase 2. So there are ongoing phase 3 trials with that drug, both in the metastatic setting and soon to come in the adjuvant setting. So I think we'll see a lot more of it. But as you alluded to, there are also other novel anti-estrogen drugs, including things like Protax, like ARV-471, which also look very promising. So I think we're going to see a lot more to come with novel endocrine treatments.
So I want to see if I can squeeze in a couple triple negative cases. But before we do, just sort of as a bridge to that, here's another HER2 low case from Dr. Malik, 72-year-old woman.
We tried starting her on everolimus and fulvestrant. She was a diabetic, so she had significant problems with hyperglycemia. So we had to stop her treatment after 1 month, despite increasing her insulin and her seeing endocrinology. She was on Gemzar for approximately 8 months. 3 months ago, she showed some progression of disease. So we re-biopsied her and she was HER2 one plus low. So I started her on TDXD and so far she's tolerating the drug well besides some fatigue.
One thing I hear about with TDXD is some hair loss and some nausea GI issues. Have you seen that?
I have. So nausea has been quite an issue and we recently got some updated recommendations also from our pharmacy team to go ahead and add in a Prepotent to help control that nausea. But the number one thing I have seen is severe fatigue.
Any comments on tolerability issues with TDXD? Again, I hear the lung people and the GI people, they say, oh, this is chemotherapy. And these are, you know, chemo-like side effects. Maybe you can call it chemo-light. Any thoughts, any comments about what you see in people on TDXD in terms of tolerability?
You know, I do think of it as chemotherapy. You know, it is a medication associated with chemotherapy toxicity. So you do see nausea. We, in fact, you know, as Dr. Malik noted, we are now using 3-drug prophylaxis with TDXD, which I think does work very well. There still is some delayed nausea, so that's important to keep in mind. And I do let patients know that they still can potentially get nausea even during week 2 and 3. So to keep ondansetron or olanzapine works very well additionally at home is great. Hair loss, again, people can go bald in about 10 to 15% of cases with TDXD. So important to warn patients about that. Our group is doing a trial looking to see if scalp cooling will help prevent that hair loss with TDXD because it's not clear if that will be the case. It can also cause neutropenia, just like other chemotherapies, and can cause the ILD. So, you know, really does have chemo toxicities.
So check out our slide deck and you'll find about like 40 papers on HER2 low that you've written. Just kidding, but I think there are about 10 of them in there. Really a lot of great concepts and data in those papers. Let's finish out. We'll see if we can do a couple of triple negative cases. A patient of Dr. Agarwal, a 45-year-old woman with locally advanced triple negative disease, residual disease after neoadjuvant pembro and chemo.
She presented with a large breast mass and was also found to have positive nodal disease. Biopsy showed invasive ductal carcinoma, grade 3, triple negative, high Ki-67. She initiated treatment with the Keynote regimen incorporating neoadjuvant immunotherapy. She had a partial response in her treatment. Her breast mass shrunk down significantly from over 10 centimeters down to about a 2-centimeter breast mass, and her node was no longer palpable. At time of surgery, she still had residual disease. She had 15 millimeters of residual invasive disease in the breast and 1 lymph node positive with 4 millimeters of disease. What would you recommend for adjuvant treatment for this patient? Would you continue adjuvant immunotherapy with pembrolizumab? Would you stop pembrolizumab and switch to capecitabine? Would you treat concurrently with immunotherapy and capecitabine? Are there any clinical trials ongoing that will help to address this question?
Any thoughts?
Those are great, great questions. And actually, we polled the Alliance Cooperative Group on this very question because we were curious as we were designing a clinical trial for this setting, what are most people doing in a patient with residual disease after getting Keynote 522? And 100% of people voted to give concurrent capecitabine and pembrolizumab. And again, this is not based on data, but more the fact that we know that these patients do have high risk of recurrence. And while in 522 they got pembro monotherapy, we know from CREATE-X that use of capecitabine can improve disease-free and overall survival. And so that's what people have been doing. There are clinical trials actually now ongoing to try to address this question. One of these trials is looking to see if we should be using an ADC in this post-pre-op setting. And so it does involve using sacituzumab with pembrolizumab and compares it to giving capecitabine with pembrolizumab. And then another trial is looking at Dato-DXd and giving it with durvalumab or the Dato alone compared to investigator choice. So I think ADCs are moving into this space.
So I guess we're going to stop here. It looks like you're getting your office cleaned also. That's great. But I feel like we just took 4 hours of stuff and brought it down to 1 hour. But I mean, I guess this is the pace we need to go at. There's so many other questions. All these questions in the chat. We have cases we didn't present. Oncology today is really an amazing thing, particularly breast cancer. And speaking of that, come on back tomorrow night. We're going to try a little experiment. No slides. We're just talking tomorrow night about upper GI cancers and HCC. Sarah, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back tomorrow night. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks.